Okay, this will be sort of an introduction to everybody else's talk, I hope, today. So in biochemical terms, we can define respiration as the oxidative pentose phosphate pathway, glycolysis, the TCA cycle, and oxidative phosphorylation. I only mention that because I just recently came across a paper that said that that was not the case, but it is in biochemical terms. But physiologically, as which is what most of us are interested in, it's the release of CO2 during heterotrophic metabolism. Now, these two definitions are certainly related, but they don't correspond exactly because heterotrophic CO2 release involves reactions that are outside of these biochemical pathways that we've just defined. As we know, the functions of respiration are to provide ATP, reducing power, and metabolic intermediates that are required to maintain life and drive growth. The ATP yield of respiration is important to overall efficiency of respiration. The classic textbook maximum or potential value is 36 ATP per glucose. Now, I consider sucrose to be the main substrate of plant respiration, so I would consider that 72 ATP per sucrose molecule. Although this 36 ATP per glucose is still taught in some college courses, actually quite a number of them, we've known for decades that that's not really true. It's much smaller than that. Without going into details, there's about 59 or perhaps 59.5 ATP per sucrose that would be the maximum value for plants. Now, that's only 82% of this textbook value. Moreover, based on recent discoveries about the physical structure of the mitochondrial ATP synthase, a mechanistic value could be calculated that's about 55 ATP per sucrose, and that's only 76% of the classic value. I'm assuming that we're all familiar with, in general terms, with the growth and maintenance respiration paradigm, which has been a very powerful tool for understanding the physiology of respiration in crops. I assume, then again, that the basic ideas are understood, that growth respiration is the CO2 released in the processes that are building new biomass. That includes substrate transport from source to sink, the assimilation of nitrogen and sulfur, building the monomers and then polymerizing them. There is a special category there that I've identified as tool maintenance, which is the turnover in RNA and enzymes that are linked directly to growth. Now, fast growth requires fast respiration, so we know that, but that's the message that we need to get out to the broader community. Maintenance respiration, then, is the CO2 that's released during the maintenance of existing biomass, turnover of proteins, ion pumping, repair of damaged cells, etc. Lots of biomass or lots of protoplasm in a crop means that there's going to be lots of respiration. We can't get away from that, but maybe we could minimize it. This is the basic growth and maintenance respiration model that I have seen is already going to show up in a couple more presentations, so I'm not going to go into a lot of details again. This is respiration is equal to a growth component, which is the growth coefficient times the growth rate plus M times W. The growth coefficient, G, is the amount of CO2 that's released for every unit of carbon, as I've written it here, every unit of carbon that's added to new biomass. The maintenance coefficient, M, is the rate of CO2 release associated with maintaining existing biomass. I want you to note that G is a ratio and M is a rate. M slows as plants get bigger or accumulate biomass because there's less protoplasm per total amount of biomass in the crop, we think. In fact, however, maintenance is better related to the amount of protoplasm than it is to total dry mass, but we can use this M times W as a simplification in interpreting data and trying to think about useful outcomes. If we do use protoplasm as the basis for maintenance respiration, the coefficient has different units and has different values. In all cases, maintenance respiration is a strong function of temperature, as far as most of us know anyway. These are some simplified illustration of that model using so I forced everything with a logistic growth model, the green curve in the upper left. This is for a 100-day growing season. The growth coefficient is 0.3 and the maintenance coefficient is 1.5% per day. Crop size is specified. The bottom left panel shows growth respiration rate in red, so it increases exponentially along with growth early in the season. It reaches a maximum about mid-season because of the logistic growth curve, and then it declines pretty precipitously. Maintenance respiration in blue, on the other hand, continues to increase in parallel with biomass during the entire season. The top right panel shows moles of carbon that are incorporated into new biomass for every mole of carbon that's released as CO2. In respiration. So there's twice as much growth as there is respiration early in the season by about day 70 in this specified model. Respiration and growth are equivalent, and then after that, respiration is dominating growth in terms of carbon fluxes. The bottom right panel is just another comparison of growth and maintenance. Early in the season, growth respiration is the big deal. Late in the season, it's almost entirely due to maintenance. Now, I've defined a couple of ratios that I'm going to call yields. To represent the retention of energy and carbon during all of heterotrophic metabolism. And these yields are both efficiencies. The yield YE, yield of energy, is the amount of energy in a product divided by the amount of energy in all the substrates used for that process. By energy, I mean heat of combustion. For heterotrophic metabolism, the substrates are photosynthesis and soil nutrients, and the substrates that I'm going to use in the calculations that I'm going to show in a little bit are listed right there with their heats of combustion. The yield YC, similarly, is the amount of carbon in the products divided by the amount of carbon in all the substrates. For yield of growth processes, I've considered 51 monomers and a couple of dozen polymers to do some calculations for potential yields for whole plants. Now, the carbon use efficiency, again, which many of us are going to talk about, summarizes overall efficiency of respiration and growth, all of heterotrophic metabolism. As it is defined in generally, I think most of us agree with this, it is defined as growth in terms of carbon divided by growth plus respiration, and that's the same as total crop growth divided by total crop photosynthesis. Note here that photosynthesis is the balance of photosynthesis and photorespiration. So basically, we're talking about light reactions and dark reactions. For example, if photosynthesis assimilates 100 moles of carbon, of CO2, respiration releases 45 of those. 55 of those are added into new biomass. The carbon use efficiency is 55%, or 0.55. So the carbon use efficiency is my yield C integrated for all of heterotrophic metabolism. And there's an energy use efficiency analogous to that, and that's just the energy in new biomass form divided by the energy in all the substrates that are used in heterotrophic metabolism. Energy use efficiency, I would say, is at least as important as carbon use efficiency because in ecological terms and with respect to human nutrition, it's often, almost always, more important what the energy balance is than what the mass balance is. We need to eat food for energy. We don't necessarily need to eat it for mass. Now, I wanted to compare carbon use and energy use efficiencies for a couple of hypothetical crops that are each growing 100 grams of biomass, but that biomass is composed only of proteins, lipids, and starch. This is simplified biomass, I know that, but I wanted to make some points. Crop A consumes 200 grams of photosynthate, and that says sucrose in my mind, to grow 87 grams starch, 10 grams of protein, and 3 grams of fat. The carbon use efficiency is almost 55%, and the energy use efficiency is a little bit higher than that. It's 3.5% larger. The energy use efficiency is greater than the carbon use efficiency because biomass is more chemically reduced than is the substrate that's used to grow new biomass. Crop B consumes more, 25% more photosynthate to grow the same 100 grams of biomass, but that biomass has twice as much protein and has 10 times as much lipid. Its carbon use efficiency is less, 4.3% less than crop A, but its energy use efficiency is 6.4% greater. And the ratio of energy use efficiency to carbon use efficiency is 11% greater in crop B relative to crop A. You might think, well, you wouldn't. Somebody might think that crop A is more efficient, uses less photosynthate to make the same 100 grams of biomass, the carbon use efficiency is greater. I'd say definitely crop B is more efficient because energy is more important than mass, and the energy use efficiency is quite a bit higher. So what about carbon use efficiency in some actual plants? These charts summarize three laboratory experiments, and I drew straight lines through this data to look at trends. There's some little squiggles that are interesting, but let's just look at the main trends here. On the left is carbon use efficiency for lettuce grown in growth chambers as a function of plant size. Carbon use efficiency declines with plant size, and Mark's going to go into detail about this, so I'm not going to say anything more about that graph. The graph on the right is for a couple of experiments with wheat. In one of those, wheat carbon use efficiency is constant for about 3/4 of the growing season, so that's the percent of maturity, so that's basically the growing season going from 0 to 100. And then around day 73, carbon use efficiency precipitously drops off in the red curve. In the blue curve, in the blue data set, carbon use efficiency just declines throughout the entire experiment. The maximum value for these three experiments is right around 60% for carbon use efficiency. These are based on CO2 exchange measurements. And in all three of these cases, carbon use efficiency declines as the plant is getting bigger or as it is reaching maturity. Now, okay, so that's some real data. Now, we calculate, or I and any number of us calculate, a potential efficiency of converting substrate into new biomass. So I'm going to give you an example for how we do that for xylose. This is a relatively simple example. Xylose is a common component of hemicellulosis, and xylan is a hemicellulose that's made up of a bunch of xylose sugars that are just attached to each other. When we add up everything, this table is an example of the reactions that are used during the synthesis of xylose, as far as we know. When we add up everything, in the table, and we balance all the inputs with the outputs. That, by the way, the Xylan that we're producing is highlighted in yellow. When everything's added up, about a half a sucrose and two ATP are enough to synthesize one xylose and then attach it to a Xylan polymer. In parallel, there's two NADH that are generated, and there's one CO2 that's released, and that CO2 is identified in green. And I want to point out that CO2 is actually counted as growth respiration, at least in my mind, but it's not coming from a respiratory pathway. So here's an example of the divergence between those biochemical definitions of respiration and the physiological one. Here's physiological respiration that wouldn't show up in a biochemical definition of respiration. Okay, so we've got this Xylan that we've added a xylose to. There's a couple of ATP that are required as input, and there's two NADH that are formed as output. So there's the summary equation again at the top. To complete the bookkeeping, when we want to try to find out how much xylose can we really make out of an amount of substrate, we eliminate all entities except for the substrate and the product and CO2 in this case. In this case, there's the net production of NADH, as I said. And by the way, in many biosynthetic reactions, there's a net production of NADH. In our bookkeeping, then, we oxidize that NADH to make ATP, and we can get 3 ATP out of those 2 NADH if we're using the 59 ATP sucrose per sucrose the same biochemistry that I'm using here in all my talk. So in the bookkeeping, there is one extra ATP that's available, and in the bookkeeping, we just use that in some other set of reactions that require ATP as input. When all the substrates are accounted for and balanced, then xylose synthesis, according to these calculations, sort of down here at the bottom, right around here, the overall efficiency in terms of carbon, I pushed the wrong thing. Okay, don't push any of the buttons, Jeff. The yield of carbon is about 86%, and the yield of energy is about 87%. Note that these calculations don't include tool maintenance, nor do they include source sink, the cost of transporting sucrose from sources to sinks. Now, tool maintenance is going to consume additional ATP, and that ATP could come from this extra ATP that's made here in oxidizing NADH, and that's how I generally treat it in most of the calculations that I do. Now, here's a summary. I calculated these potential yield of carbon and yield of energy values for biosynthesis. This is just yields for biosynthesis of major biomass components. So this is a refinement of what's been done by many people before me. I'm just updating things with our recent newer information about the bioenergetics and the biochemical reactions. These results also exclude source sink transport, and they exclude tool maintenance. And all the calculations are best case. Nitrogen supplied as ammonia, there's no waste anywhere. This is kind of the maximum that we could get. So cellulose and starch are on the left, very, very high efficiencies. Crops containing large fractions of cellulose or starch might therefore have large overall carbon use efficiencies. The hemicelluloses and lignins, as we're moving to the right, those individual dots are not for polymers. Those are for monomers that would be used to make polymers, so the polymers would be made up of some combination of those individual dots. For the hemicelluloses, both YC and YE are pretty high. They exceed 80%. For the lignins, though, the yields are modest at best. And here, again, the energy use efficiencies, the red dots are greater than the black dots because the lignin monomers are more reduced than the substrate that's making them. So they retain more of the energy than they do of the carbon. Then moving a little bit farther over to the right, the lipids diverge greatly. The energy values for lipids are very high, around 87% is the cluster, but the carbon values are much smaller, around 66%. This indicates, of course, that we might expect for an oil crop, the carbon use efficiency could be pretty crappy, but the energy use efficiency still could be very high, which it is in reality. For 12 representative proteins, there's 3 storage proteins and 9 major enzymes in there. They all cluster pretty tightly around 73% for both energy and carbon. And then finally, the organic acids over on the right are quite efficient with respect to energy. So all of these things would go into adding things up to get a hypothetical C carbon use efficiency for growth in crops. Now, so that's the biosynthesis end of things. What about the theory for maintenance? We do understand the specific metabolic costs of most maintenance processes. We know about protein turnover. We know about pumping ions. What we don't know much about is what the rates of those things are in actual crops. So we're stymied. We know what's part of the equation is, but we don't know what the other part of the equation is. For example, if we know that it takes 1 ATP to pump an ion, and we know that we can get 59 ATP out of a sucrose, we know we can pump 59 ions with 1 sucrose. Okay, that's great. We just don't know how much ion pumping is going on, so we can't calculate how much CO2 is going to be released, how much sucrose is going to get consumed. That's the same for protein turnover. That's the same for repair, et cetera, et cetera. So we're kind of in a kind of in a tight spot because we understand the mechanisms, but we can't really add things up for maintenance. That's the theory. What about measuring maintenance? I would say that we're not too much better off in terms of measuring maintenance respiration than we are with calculating it. Despite decades of research, our ability to measure this, particularly in the field, is still problematic. Mark's going to talk about some of this again. My present crude assessment is that the maintenance coefficient is at moderate temperature is the equivalent of about 1.5 to 3.5% of existing biomass per day that's lost in maintenance respiration. That fraction, and it's a strong function of temperature, as I said before, and it declines, that 1.5% to 3.5% generally declines as the crop is getting bigger and or getting older, because the fraction of the old crop that's in protoplasm is a little bit less than it is in a young crop, I think. Now, we estimate that maintenance is roughly half of crop respiration. I'd say maybe a little bit more than half in general, but that roughly is still awfully rough. That's not really helpful once we get beyond the kind of arm-waving thing, you know, like it's about half. Well, how much more than half or less? We don't. It's tough to say. Now, I'm advocating that we revive an old approach to quantifying carbon use efficiency, and we could call it a new approach. For example, you could expose a crop to some labeled carbon, either 13 carbon or radiocarbon, measure how much CO2 label that crop assimilates at some point in time, and then some point later in time, maybe even at maturity, you measure how much label is left in the plant. That second measurement divided by the first measurement is the carbon use efficiency, so it really can't be too much simpler than that. The general approach was used in the 60s and 70s and 80s quite a bit. The measurement technology is a lot better today. I'm not sure why it's not used more today. It certainly was used in the past to some benefit. Now, there are plenty of difficulties. Some of the respired label is reassimilated. The amount of time between those measurements, 1 and 2, affects the carbon use efficiency result. Some of the label can be lost in upsized leaves, so forth. There's lots of problems. But I still advocate that this is a potentially powerful method to study carbon use efficiency that could be used in situ for whatever crop you're interested in. Okay, now, as an example of this, Roger Austin and his colleagues labeled field-grown wheat canopies with radiocarbon. So this is the whole crop. Then they measured the fraction of the label that was still in the shoots at maturity. And that averaged over these three different labeling times to be 57% in that blue line. If we allow for a bit of radiocarbon in the roots, let's say that the carbon use efficiency was maybe 58% for the whole crop, which is close, by the way, to the 60% that I just highlighted from those growth chamber experiments with both lettuce and wheat. So we're still bumping up around 60% for the whole crop carbon use efficiency. If, in fact, getting down into the green box here now, if, in fact, respiration is about evenly divided between growth and maintenance, then that's a big assumption. But if we make that assumption, then the yield YC of the growth processes was about 73%. From theory, assuming the best case for biosynthesis and C3 grain crop biomass that's supplied with ammonia, the yield of the growth processes in terms of carbon could be as large as 82%. And the difference between 73 and 82, some of that might be due to nitrate reduction in the actual crop. But for this crop, the measurement-based estimate is quite a bit smaller than theory. The nitrate reduction would only, I think, bring the 82% down to around maybe about 80%. This might also indicate, it might indicate that the theory and the measurements don't agree at all. It also might indicate that maintenance respiration is considerably more than half of total respiration, because that's the assumption that went into the 73%. Okay, so that's a whole canopy. The situation is a little bit different if we label individual leaves. For photosynthate, so this is a little bit later experiment, either labeling the flag leaf or the penultimate leaf. And for photosynthate in the penultimate leaf, the carbon use efficiency through to maturity is, lo and behold, about 60%. Okay, so 60% showing up a lot here, at least in the slides that I've got. But the carbon use efficiency for flag leaf photosynthesis was 78%. We actually expect, or some of us do expect, a greater carbon use efficiency for flag leaf photosynthesis at least after anthesis, because that carbon that leaf is assimilating is mainly exported to growing seeds, where it's rapidly converted into storage compounds. There's not much need for maintenance in the growing seed. Total respiration is therefore dominated by growth in the photosynthate that's coming out of the flag leaf. The respiration that is dominated by growth, maintenance is more or less inconsequential, and we would expect the overall efficiency to go up. Remember in my graphs early on, when growth rate was rapid, growth, respiration dominated, and growth over, or respiration over growth was a pretty small number. Now, the penultimate leaf photosynthate, though, is more broadly distributed through the plant, and a larger fraction is going to get used for maintenance throughout the plant. Hence, that efficiency goes down. Happens to go down to about 60%. Is that 78% carbon use efficiency realistic? In theory, there's three things that are really important. Mobilizing the photosynthate in the leaf, and so I've said for a pool that's 50% starch and 50% sucrose, you can get about 98% of that stuff out of the leaf. Phloem loading uses up a little bit to generate some ATP. The phloem loading itself and transporting it to the grain, you can get about 98% of that. And for growing 80% starch, 15% protein, and 5% lipid in the seed, that can be carried out theoretically with an efficiency of about 90.5%. If we multiply those all together, we could take photosynthate from the flag leaf, convert it into storage compounds in the seed with an efficiency of about 87.5%. That's the theory. So the 78% is plausible. In fact, we might expect it to be a little bit more than 78%. But consider again that in the flag leaf, some of that photosynthate is transported other places. It's used for maintenance in the flag leaf. It's used for maintenance in the rest of the plant. It's used for some maintenance in the seed. So a little bit of the difference between that 87 and 78 can easily be explained away by maintenance. But the 78% is certainly plausible. Now, let me kind of summarize where I am, and then we can get some talks that are going to get into some more of the details of things. When carbon use efficiency is going to be high when relative growth rate is fast, that's because growth respiration dominates total respiration, and the ratio of growth to respiration is going to be highest when growth relative growth rate is fast. This is most typical in young plants. Now, the second little bullet under number one there, though, it may also be the case that the PO ratio of photosynthesis is highest in rapidly growing cells. A key point, perhaps. Now, there's a conundrum here. If growth is fast, carbon use efficiency is high. That's just what the math says. If intrinsic carbon use efficiency in a plant is high, we might expect the growth rate to be high because it's doing more growth with the photosynthate. Which is cause and which is effect? I don't know. Efficiency should be, moving on to number two, efficiency should be high when lots of inexpensive biomass is synthesized, like cellulose and starch. So there's trade-offs, though, because fast photosynthesis and growth are going to require a lot of protein, and protein is expensive to make and maintain. So there's a trade-off there. Cheap biomass, high efficiency. We don't want cheap biomass if we want to have a lot of photosynthate. Lipids are a special case because they have a large yield of the energy, but they have a low yield of carbon for their biosynthesis. Now, respiration might also be, in number three, most efficient when protoplasm is a small fraction of total biomass because maintenance is then relatively slow. But again, a large amount of protoplasm is needed for rapid photosynthesis. So we're also, we want efficiency, but we the way we might get it isn't necessarily going to be good for overall growth. How efficient could respiration be? At infinite growth rate, maintenance would be insignificant, and total respiration would be dominated by growth, and the overall efficiency would approach the yield of carbon and yield of energy for the growth processes. Now, for C3 cereals growing on ammonia, best case, that could mean a carbon use efficiency of about 82%. That includes tool maintenance and transport and everything. At the energy end of it, the yield might even be 86%. So those are pretty high efficiencies that are not anything like the 60% that we've seen in the experiments so far, the ones that I've identified anyway. Now, obviously, infinite growth is not possible. That might explain it right there. Where in storage organs, where maintenance respiration is also slow, respiratory efficiency could tend toward, but wouldn't quite obtain, the theoretical YC and YE for biosynthesis values of storage compounds, starch, again, being easy to synthesize. For the ideal case of whole plants, carbon use efficiency could be about 0.7 or 70% over a season. That might be a breakdown of 50% for maintenance, 15% of photosynthesis for growth. And then in both cases, temperature is going to be important to keep maintenance down. Why would a crop have large carbon use efficiency? Well, because storage organs don't require very much maintenance, and crops have a lot of storage organs. The biosynthesis of storage carbohydrates is pretty cheap, so if you're growing a starch crop or a sugar crop, expect a high carbon use and energy use efficiency. High protein crops, though, are going to require significant growth respiration. That CUE might not be so high. Again, oil crops are complicated. High carbon use efficiency, low energy use efficiency. And for herbaceous crops based on cellulose and hemicellulose skeletons, we're going to expect those to have a higher carbon use efficiency than woody tissue. Finally, can we improve yield by doing something about improving respiration? I say yes, maybe, if some respiration is not necessary or inefficient and we got rid of it, yes. So there is evidence that there's genetic variation in maintenance respiration and evidence that slower maintenance can lead to bigger growths, more growth. So when I look at Hugh's recent paper on this from last year and I study that paper, the references he cites and the references in those references, I come to the conclusion that, in fact, more efficient respiration does give us bigger plants, and maybe there's a cause and effect relationship there. I think the PO ratio is submaximal in mature cells, so we might be able to select for larger PO ratio in mature cells, and that might improve maintenance, that might reduce maintenance respiration. That too might actually explain one. My assessment or guess is that growth respiration is already nearly maximum in crops. I don't know that, but I'm not sure we can do very much there. And finally, I would propose this using labeled carbon to screen for enhanced in situ carbon use efficiency. Is there genetic variation in carbon use efficiency, and could we use that variation to improve crops? Okay, so there we go.
No, that's fine. I'm going to cut you off sooner, but okay. Then you cited me. So.